This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Moscow. Felix Leit of CBS News and the Moscow Times reporting on the politics of the moment, with the Ukrainian story dominating the news in Europe. The Russian parliament, especially one senator in the ruling party, has asked or recommended or pleaded or implored his government, and in fact Russians everywhere, to arm the separatists. These are the young men and women in the Donbas area of eastern Ukraine that has been separated from the parliament, the Rada, for these 7 years. Felix, a very good day to you. The Russian ruling party urges the Kremlin to arm the Ukraine separatists. Now, at first glance, this looks to be gilding the lily because the separatists are well armed. Is this a surprise story to Moscow? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. It kind of depends on what way you cut the cookie in this case. You know, we all know perfectly well that for the last 8 years, Russia has been arming the Donbass separatists, right? The Donbass republics, the Luhansk People's Republic and the Donetsk People's Republic, these sort of self-proclaimed, unrecognized states that appeared in that sort of spring of 2014, when Russia stirred up unrest in the Russian-speaking regions of East Ukraine, have always been very, very, very dependent on sort of Russian military largesse. And quite frankly, you know, more recently, they are de facto sort of incorporated into Russia. You know, Donbass citizens can actually vote in Russian elections. They have Russian passports. Economically, you know, Donbass companies can according to a recent law, can actually receive sort of Russian government contracts. So they're very, very, very integrated into Russia right now. The significance of this announcement is more that they're making it open than making it sort of publicly known that they're doing it, rather than they're going to do anything in particular. You know, the Russian side, critically, for these 8 years has denied that it's doing anything sort of untoward in the Donbass. It largely denied that it is sort of that it has been sort of that any kind of Russian troops or any kind of Russian largesse is involved in propping up the People's Republics. And so what this means, and this guy Turchak, you know, he's not you wouldn't call him Putin's inner circle, but he's very much a second rank official. And I mean that almost in a positive way. You know, there are many, 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 many ranks of government official, or, you know, of Putin loyalists below him. So he is not an insignificant figure. And the fact that someone like him, you know, the head, not just the senator, but the head of the ruling party, the head of United Russia, Putin's political party, has come out to say this, you know, it's not insignificant. Right. You know, it does seem that sort of the Russians are dropping their sort of policy of, you know, implausible deniability on support for the eastern Ukrainian separatists.
But as of yet, there is no conversation about Russian military personnel in the Donbass, especially officers and those coordinating the defense. That has not been in the news yet. Is that correct, Felix?
Well, no. I mean, there's no. So far, we do not have sort of any kind of move towards admitting that. But as we understand it, you know, there are a number of Russian personnel, Russian sort of troops in the Donbass, and indeed the Donbass militias themselves are actually integrated into the Russian army's military command. They're part of the structure. So there's a very high degree of integration there. And I think sort of one of the scenarios that could play out here is a more formal recognition of the Donbass, perhaps the introduction of more explicit Russian military presence into the region. And so this might be sort of laying the ground for that. We really don't know. You know, the Donbass has, I think, in recent sort of days, really become front and center in this Ukraine crisis. You know, seems that Russia wants to use the Donbass, use that wedge in Ukraine to sort of, you know, push for more leverage in the country. But we'll really have to see.
Italy, recovering from the pandemic, Italy led by Mario Draghi until and if he becomes president, and then there'll be no prime minister, in the news because of a conversation that has now taken place between Vladimir Putin and leading Italian executives. What I love about this story, Felix, is that it completely ignores the sanction talk of the European Union. Is this a surprise that Italy, I read from your reporting, has many businesses in Russia? Are they prominent in Russian consumer lives?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a surprise at all, actually. You know, of all EU countries, and certainly of the major sort of, you know, top five EU countries, Italy has always been the one with the closest ties to Russia. And that's, you know, political. That sort of goes back to, you know, the Berlusconi years when Berlusconi was very close to Putin, but also before that when the Italian Communist Party in its day was very, very large and influential. You know, Italy has always had very, very close links to Russia. And the business links come first of all. You know, you will see sort of Italian brands, you know, whether that's cars, whether that's food, whether that's sort of clothing, anything sort of that Italy is famous for, you know, is popular in Russia, and Russia is a major export market for this sort of stuff. So I'm not surprised at all.
The fiasco of Moscow. Now we go to the Russian markets, reporting that the Russian markets have been selling off in sympathy with the American technology markets. A lot of Russians holding Microsoft and Apple. Is that it, Felix? What is selling?
Not quite. I mean, you know, I'm not quite up to date with the reasons for the American market decline. But in Russia, you know, we've not got a decline. We've got sort of I call it more of a small collapse. You know, the currency, the ruble is down quite substantially as well. And this is fundamentally about war fears. You know, the economic news in Russia, you know, kind of on the surface of it, until this present crisis, had not actually been that bad. You know, you would see sort of fairly buoyant recovery, actually. You know, Russia sort of traded a fairly high loss of life in the pandemic for a fairly soft economic hit. And that sort of bet paid off in the sense that the Russian economy rebounded quite strongly and quite quickly. But really, you know, what we've seen in the last few weeks is sort of a lot of those gains, you know, wiped away, especially among sort of blue chip firms, the currency markets. You know, we really sort of have seen quite a substantial decline. And, you know, it's hard to say sort of what this means almost for the ruble in one's pocket. Because sort of, you know, even in those sort of the relatively good years, you know, the last year, 2021 for the Russian economy, economic growth, you know, that recovery really wasn't reflected in sort of purchasing power and wages and sort of, you know, the Russian consumer, the Russian sort of citizen was already sort of racked by pretty high inflation here. So I think, you know, this is really just another kind of a nail in the coffin right now. But then, of course, you could see a rebound if this present sort of geopolitical crisis dissipates. So, you know, no sort of obituaries for the Russian economy quite yet, I think.
Checking on the markets, I've been checking in your native London and your native Scotland, your British Isles. I've been also checking in the south of France and in Australia. Do you see empty shelves in Moscow, missing brand names or one kind of milk and not another? Are you seeing shortages?
I wouldn't say so. You know, shortages are sort of pretty uncommon. You know, again, it's most likely a very different picture outside Moscow. But in Moscow, no. I think the real issue and what you see with this sort of inflationary crisis or pressures is sort of that issue of rising prices, because you have to remember that a lot of Russians are on fixed incomes. You know, this is a very old country, a very pensioner-heavy country, and the indexation of pensions, you know, pegging pensions to inflation, is a hugely controversial political topic, which, you know, comes up all the time and is never really done by the government because it's too expensive, because there's too many pensioners. And so, you know, this is, I think, the real issue here, you know, prices that have really surged sort of over the course of the last year or so.
There's a blackout in Central Asia, in Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan. As of the reporting in Moscow, there is no one source of the blackout. The countries are hit hard. To my knowledge, this is the first pan-Central Europe blackout. Is there any suggestion that it's political in nature, or is this an infrastructure that just seized up?
As I understand, it is strictly an infrastructural question. It's been blamed by the Uzbek government, I believe, on an accident in southern Kazakhstan. You've got to remember that you know, these are sort of independent countries, and they have been for 30 years, but, you know, their infrastructure is, if not sort of Soviet vintage, then at least, you know, the foundations were laid in the Soviet Union. And so these are very, like, countries that are extremely interconnected economically. You know, power lines and sort of you know, grid systems really do sort of overlap borders. And of course, you've got to remember that that part of the world has these ludicrously sort of complicated borders, you know, with multiple exclaves in multiple countries. And so, you know, when sort of you know, someone sneezes in Kyrgyzstan, they really do catch a cold in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, I think. And this is really a sort of an example of that.
And we're looking at people stranded in elevators. This is reporting within these hours from the Moscow Times. Stranded in elevators.
Yes, from our man in Bishkek, yes.
Right, and pushing buses because they're powered by electricity overhead lines. So we're really talking about damage to a wide region, especially the very troubled Almaty, which has not yet recovered from the turmoil. And finally, a positive story. Navalny goes to Sundance. How so?
Yes, there's been a documentary made of his sort of travails at the start of last year, the start of 2021, when he, of course, sensationally returned to Russia, was very much in the eye of all the world at that time, I think. And, of course, the rather amusing episode where he managed to unmask his would-be killer via a prank call. So this has all been sort of put onto the big screen. Apparently, I haven't watched it actually, I must say, but it apparently has the sort of the aesthetic of like a Jason Bourne film. So, you know, I think I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it when I can.
And appearing at the Sundance Film Festival, which is probably virtual, but in any event, Navalny in the news. And I'm going to guess that this is going to perform very well at all the film festivals across 2022. Felix Leit for CBS News in Moscow. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.